we will move to the second panel, which is about the role of international actors in shaping the hierarchy of memories. We have three wonderful speakers to talk about different case studies from different parts of the world, both about the role of international actors as about the dynamics within countries and the influence of external actors. I will introduce the speakers one by one and before their presentations, and then they will have about 12 minutes. And at the end of this panel, there will be about 10 minutes for Q&A. So again, I encourage you to post your questions in the Q&A function. We will start with Professor Jasna Dragovic-Soso, who's a professor of international politics and history at Goldsmiths, University of London. She's currently working on transitional justice and processes of memory construction of the Yugoslav wars of the 1990s. She mainly focuses on issues regarding the issue of coming to terms with the past from a comparative perspective, and especially Serbian politics of acknowledging the Srebrenica genocide, public debates about wartime responsibility and denial, and various attempts to create truth commissions in the post-Yugoslav region. She's the author of Saviors of the Nation, Serbia's Intellectual Opposition and the Revival of Nationalism from 2002, and a co-author, co-editor of A State Collapse in Southeastern Europe, New Perspective on Yugoslavia's Dissolution, which is from 2008. Her presentation today will be slightly conceptual, and the title is Memory and Justice in the Aftermath of War and Mass Crime, Contemporary Serbia and the West German Model. I encourage you to have a look at our website, hegemonicnarratives.com, where you can also see the abstracts and you can read a bit more about the authors and the presenters. Jasna, over to you. I'm unmuting you. I'm just going to share your presentation, so just give me a moment when I load this up.
Thanks very much, Jessie. I'll use the time to just say a big thank you to you and Johanna for organizing this and for pursuing it even when everything else collapsed in the middle of the crisis. So thanks to both of you. I know this was a no mean feat, to put it bluntly, and that you've put a lot of work into this. Okay, so I will be very short. I've been given 12 minutes and I will try and stick to that. But the title of my presentation, as you can see, is Memory and Justice in the Aftermath of War and Mass Crime, Contemporary Serbia and the West German Model. And it is less, I would say, about the role of international actors in shaping the hierarchy of memories than about international models and hegemonic narratives, although, of course, the two are related. Now, as Jesse said, I work on transitional justice and memory politics in the post-conflict Balkans. And the thing that has struck me, and I would suggest many of us who work on the region over the years, has been the extent to which Germany, and specifically West Germany, has been a reference point in so many discussions about dealing with the legacy of the wars of the 1990s. While I think this has been the case throughout the post-Yugoslav region, I would also venture to say that it has been most commonly the case in Serbia. It should be noted, of course, that the references to West Germany's experience are not unique to the region. As many scholars have shown, the notion of West Germany as the model penitent, to use Thomas Berger's term, has achieved global iconic status since the 1990s. Acting as a reference point for international policymakers, representatives, donors, scholars, and activists, as well as for local ones in a variety of settings. As the German sociologist Misha Gabovich notes in a recent volume, which is called Replicating Atonement, and which I highly recommend, Germany's experience of dealing with its Nazi past has been used both as a yardstick and a foil. In other words, both as a model to emulate and as a tool to evaluate other countries' approaches towards their own difficult pasts, usually to show, in fact, how they've fallen short. Mostly, this has been done by applying an ideal typical German model of atonement, stripped of the specificities, contradictions, and nuances of Germany's actual historical experience of dealing with its Nazi past. It is also clear that the exact ingredients and interpretations of the German model will vary according to the country and the actors who refer to it. So, how has the German model of atonement manifested itself in contemporary Serbia? And here I would argue the understanding of the German model has been focused on five main tropes. The first and the earliest of these references to the German case related, of course, to the creation of the ICTY as a new Nuremberg. In other words, as an international tribunal to judge the war crimes and atrocities committed in the Yugoslav wars of the 1990s. There are, of course, significant differences between the two tribunals, but what is important for our purposes here is that both of these tribunals had in common an important pedagogic element to their mission. They were meant not only to serve justice, but also to counter denial of the crimes and to educate publics in order to promote normative change in the countries affected. And it is this mission that has been the focal point of the interactions between Western interlocutors and Serbian ones, as well as in the debates within Serbian society itself. Secondly, there was the trope of, to quote one Serbian activist, denazification, apology, and the example of Willy Brandt. The call for denazification was particularly hotly debated during the Kosovo War in 1999, when some Serbian activists called for the creation of an international protectorate and the mass purge of Serbian institutions along the lines undertaken by the Allies in Germany in the 1940s, neglecting, of course, to acknowledge that denazification was soon abandoned and almost completely reversed by the 1950s. While such calls subsided after the fall of Milosevic in 2000, of longer duration have been demands for an apology by Serbia to the other post-Yugoslav nations for the wars and for the crimes committed by the Serbs in the 1990s. These have been a constant phenomenon over the last two decades, and references to Willy Brandt's iconic genuflection at the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial have been ubiquitous. A third key reference has been Karl Jaspers' famous treatise on the question of German guilt. And this really has resonated within Serbian intellectual circles in particular. And many Serbian anti-war intellectuals reference this text as a guide both to defining Serbia's guilt for the wars of the 1990s, but also as a way of demarcating their own moral stance towards the crimes that were committed. Fourth, the post-Second World War Franco-German reconciliation has also been a recurrent trope invoked in particular by representatives of European governments, institutions, and NGOs with Serbian counterparts as well as other regional actors. It should, however, be said that in this case, this particular trope has been referenced less by locals who are generally more skeptical about the notion of reconciliation. And finally, I think it's important to note that references to the German model have also been invoked over the years by opponents of a reckoning with the recent past, with the 1990s. And this has included both some Western scholars and also some Serbian intellectuals and politicians. And their argument is that it is simply too early for Serbia to address its own recent past, that even in Germany, it took 20 years for any meaningful confrontation with the Nazi legacy to emerge. Some of these have argued that Serbia first needs to focus on rebuilding its economy and establishing a democracy, and that such a reckoning could come later. Others, in fact, consider this kind of memory work to be futile and believe that rather than focusing on the past, Serbia, like other countries, should focus on the future. I think it is important to emphasize in this very short and schematic overview that the whole nature of a hegemonic model is not that it is simply exported from somewhere, but actually that it takes root in societies to which it is exported, to use the term. And it is important to note that the various tropes described have been pervasive in internal debates and public discussions in Serbia, especially within civil society, among intellectuals, and in the media. Okay, in the very last part of my presentation, I would like to make three final points that will perhaps open up to questions and comments. First of all, I think it is important to note the problematic nature of having any ideal type model for dealing with the past, such as the West German model of atonement. For anyone who has studied West Germany's history of memory, it is clear to what extent this very complex and indeed unfinished history has been misunderstood, oversimplified, and misinterpreted in order to serve various local and international agendas. It is also unproductive, I think, to believe that any one society's experience can be replicated or exportable to very different geographic and temporal circumstances. A more fruitful way forward, in my view, would be to look at West Germany's experience in all its complexity. The turning points, the causes and stop-start nature of various initiatives, the existence of parallel discourses, and the reasons for their variable public resonance over time, the role of domestic and international actors, as well as the political, social, and economic context, and so on. If we do so, we might understand why certain initiatives and memory events had less resonance than hoped or expected, while others were more socially or politically impactful. Which brings me to my second and related point. When considering Germany's history of memory, I think it is interesting to see that the tropes that are most often referenced in the sort of German model that has been exported, in other words, Nuremberg, denazification, Jaspers, Willy Brandt, and so on, that these were not necessarily the ones that had the greatest resonance internally for West Germany's processes of dealing with its past, at least not at the time in which they took place. On the other hand, when looking at Germany's history of memory, it does seem that there were other more potentially impactful memory events, such as, for example, the Holocaust-specific trials in the first half of the 1960s. And here I'm referring, of course, to the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, but primarily also to the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trials. Or mass media events, like the screening of the American TV series Holocaust in 1979. Or certain types of commemorative activities, such as the Crimes of the Wehrmacht exhibition in the 1990s. Yet what is interesting is that these have been neglected in both external and internal references to the German experience, and have also been remarkably absent from debates in Serbia. My third and final point would be, and here I'm in agreement with Gabovic, that a more fruitful way of approaching the West German case would indeed be to see it as a springboard for reflections about other cases, such as that of Serbia. If we are going to gain from such a comparison, I would argue, we also then need to apply the same temporal lens. And considering that the obvious starting point for Serbia would be the year 2000, following the end of the Kosovo War and the fall of the Milosevic regime, this implies that any meaningful comparative study would need to examine the equivalent period in Germany, from the end of the Second World War, roughly up until the mid-1960s, analyzing both the considerable parallels between these two case studies at the time, and also the very significant differences between them and the implications of this. Approached in this way, I believe, the West German case could serve as a useful reference for building Serbia's own history of memory since 2000. And I would venture to conclude, it could perhaps also allow us to understand the very different endpoints of those both countries' 20-year post-war trajectories, with West Germany in the mid-1960s really perched on the threshold of some pretty significant change, and Serbia in 2020 appearing further away than ever from engaging in any real reckoning with its own legacy of war and mass crime. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Yasna. That was, I think, a brilliant introduction also to the panel and how the different experiences can travel. And I feel that our second speaker is also very well equipped to build on this. And I think your two presentations are greatly interlinked. And then obviously we're gonna go to Rachel's presentation. So I think it's gonna be a few themes that are gonna be re-emerging. So let me introduce the second speaker of today, which is Lord Alderdice, John Alderdice, whom I should have actually also introduced as the director of the Center for the Resolution of Intractable Conflict at Harris Manchester College, which is just across the road from my department. And Crick is also one of the partners of this conference, so I should have mentioned that in the beginning. Lord Alderdice is actually a psychiatrist by profession, but we probably mainly know him as the leader of the Alliance Party of Northern Ireland, as he played a very significant role in the talks on Northern Ireland, including the negotiation of the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. He was the first speaker of the new Northern Ireland Assembly, and he's held many international positions, including as the president of Liberal International. Since 1996, he has sat as a Liberal Democrat Life member of the House of Lords. And currently, as I said, he's not only based at Harris Manchester College, but he's also the chairman of the Centre for Democracy and Peacebuilding in Belfast and president d'honneur of Liberal International. He'll speak on a presentation with the title of Casting Some Light on the Long Dark Shadow of the Past. John, the floor is yours. And thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, well, let's try and see if we can share this screen. Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed for the kind invitation to come along and talk a little bit for a short time about how we deal with the past, which is a very difficult problem for all of us individually and also as communities. Well, the first thing to say is that we all live out our memories. It's not possible for us as human beings, because of the way that we are constructed, to simply come to any new experience and take it as a tabula rasa. All of us come with a perspective from the past. When you bump into someone, how they look, the type of name that they have, what assumptions you make about them from your experience of meeting with similar people in similar circumstances in the past, positively or negatively, influences how you perceive that. And so when we come to these things as individuals or communities, it's impossible for us not to be influenced by the past. Of course, the question is, which memories from the past? Because we have massive amounts of memory. Which of them do we choose? And of course, I don't necessarily mean choose in a conscious way, although we can do that. But there are all sorts of assumptions that we make, which will emphasize some memories, minimize other memories, ignore some, and in the case of others, completely block them out. We can consciously do that, but often it seems to happen in an almost automatic fashion. Well, one important element of memories from the past in terms of the development of our narrative as individuals or as communities, and I often do draw things across between individuals and communities, but I'd emphasize that the psychology of communities is not simply a direct read across from the psychology of individuals. It's not exactly the same thing. But there are certain interesting common factors because we are human beings. Well, Vamik Volkan has pointed out that there are two important elements which are relevant to what we are talking about, post-conflict, elements which are chosen, which are victories from the past or traumas from the past. And these have a profound impact, not only on what we believe, how we function intellectually, but how we engage and identify with others. Our whole way of being in the world is enormously influenced by those things which are positive, victories, successes from the past, and traumas from the past. Obviously, defeats are traumas, but there are lots of other kinds of traumas as well. And these memories are not necessarily precise memories of single experiences. Even when they seem to be, they are a complex or collage which include, and indeed exclude, aspects of our history and how we feel about these things. So, for example, specific stories, memories, experiences from the past seem to be particularly striking. And often people will say, well, I wonder why that particular trauma was picked out over against all the other traumas, that particular death, or indeed that particular success, is picked out over against lots of others. And is it really very accurate? We heard earlier on about how particular stories can be presented in particular ways. Actually, they always are. If something is important enough to be remembered, it's usually because it exemplifies a whole series of other things. It is, in that sense, a kind of example of lots of other experiences, and it may not be that it is a precisely historically accurate example, but it has all sorts of emotional and other components, and it represents lots and lots of experiences. Whenever you experience a certain thing, you say, ah, yes, always like, or that's the way they always deal with us. And if you were to point out that, well, that's not entirely accurate, it doesn't matter. It doesn't convince the person that they should give it up. Now, sometimes people describe these cultural memories or stories as myths. And what they usually mean when they're saying that is, it's not accurate. That's just a myth. We heard this said, for example, during the Brexit Remain debate, each side saying, oh, what you're talking about, just a myth, or it's just old history. Well, that's a misunderstanding. A myth is not something that never happened historically. That's not the important thing about it. The important thing is that it is representing something of the human condition that's actually happening all the time. But why are we bothered to read Shakespeare or Greek and Roman myths? These are things from a long time ago, and some people dismiss them. They say, oh, this is just an old nonsense stories. Well, the reason that they're powerful psychologically for individuals and communities is because they represent something of what is happening all the time, repeatedly, in human experience. In the case of countries, of course, victories or defeats are one kind of element of that, particularly related to our subject, that of conflict. So when we look at myths, it's not a question of us saying, well, it's really important for me to listen to the myths of this community and how this community interprets its history so that I can correct them. But that's nonsense. First of all, you won't correct them because they will simply not believe what you have to say. Because they'll say, you don't really understand. You're external. You don't understand my history and my background at all. Nor can you, because you come from another place than me. If you're coming from an imperial background, you can't understand me because I was colonized. If you come from a colonizing background, it can be the opposite way around. The person from the imperial background says, well, you don't actually understand what was happening with us either. That's not what's important. What's important is that if we listen to the myths that a community tells, it can help us to understand the disturbed historic relationships they have been inhabiting. And that gives us the potential basis to create new healthy relationships for the future, if people want it. One of the things you learn as a psychiatrist is that you shouldn't assume that everybody wants good relationships with everybody. Some people are very happy to continue to have bad relationships with some people because it feeds certain stories that they tell about themselves. So we shouldn't assume that everybody wants to have good relationships. But if they do, then myths can be a way into it, not by believing or not believing them, but by understanding what the purpose of them is. Now, memories and myths can be described in narrative ways, and that's very often what we do as academics. We write papers about things, we talk about things and so on. But actually, because we are conveying feelings more than just thoughts, they can be sometimes much more powerfully conveyed symbolically in poetry and song, in drama and film, in music and various kinds of art forms, particularly in folk art. I'm not dismissing high art, but folk art can sometimes tell us a great deal more. So I'm going to take just three examples very quickly. One, of course, from home, from Northern Ireland. And I've put up here two murals. It's very common, especially in Belfast, but also in other parts of Northern Ireland, for people to paint the walls of houses with murals that tell a story. And here are two murals. One on the left is coming from a loyalist Protestant unionist background, and the other on the right is from a Catholic nationalist Republican background. And you'll see that both of them are telling a story. The one on the left, you'll see there are two photographs and then the paramilitary in the center. And there are two sets of flags, one on the left and one on the right. The photograph of the man on the left and the flags on the right, on the left, are from a loyalist organization from the 1800s, which was protecting the position of Protestant loyalists who felt under threat and about to be betrayed by the British, which of course they were. The one on the right shows a more recent paramilitary with his badges and flags just below him. It's linking the memory of the past with the present. And although the reality of the history and situation now and then is different, what they're wanting to do is show a continuity that they are fulfilling from the past. Similarly on the right, you can see on the left-hand side of the right mural, which is a Republican one, you can see pictures of Republicans, rebels, the IRA, from the early part of the 20th century, linked over on the extreme right of the mural with a picture of a hunger striker and someone with a Molotov cocktail, representing the current, as it was then when this mural was painted 10 or 15 years ago, by Republicans, linking their past memory with how it was in the present. And on the top, I've put in the motif of the Northern Ireland Assembly. And that is because it brings together the two divided sides. If we look at some pictures from Colombia here, we see on the left a politician who was trying to bring about a peaceful resolution. When he was assassinated, it moved more to the violence of FARC. And you see a painting of the FARC leader who died some years ago. And a new kind of picture on the right, which is done by a young artist who's talking about the victory of peace, a bringing together of the two sides. In Peru also, you'll see the history of the past, the Incas at Machu Picchu who had fled from the intrusion of the imperial Spaniards. And on the right, coffins of those who were killed by Shining Path as they fought against those who were in government. Now, I finish, if I may, with two quick slides. One is to say that in Northern Ireland, we came to accept the myths and memories of both sides as valid and worked to build new relationships. Whereas in Colombia, the hegemonic myth of the governing minority was given precedence and the peace process is faltering. And in Peru, the hegemonic myth of the minority, of the governing minority is the only one that's heard, and history is just dismissed as just history. And the final comment on public policy implications. We need to understand history because the myths that each side tells, and no side tells an absolute truth about anything, it's not possible. All we can do is describe the condensed feeling and thinking and behaving of our side, often conveyed best and more nuanced in art of various kinds. But if we come in from outside, and this is the external question, from outside and become partisan to accept one side of the argument, we are simply becoming part of the problem, not part of the solution. In the final comment, we need to see the Brexit debate, for example, as a conflict of two historic hegemonic narratives. It's not one side or the other. That's why Britain was so deeply split. These are hegemonic narratives of profound historic significance, going back to the Reformation and way back beyond that. And the idea that we tell stories to persuade ourselves and others is absolutely nothing new. The Gospel of St. John is completely different from the three synoptic gospels, because the writer was trying to get across his story to a Greco-Roman audience and not to an old Judeo-Palestinian audience. I leave it there. Thank you for your forbearance.
Thank you so much, John. That was fascinating. From Europe and Latin America, we will now move to East Africa. John, if you could stop sharing, I think our third speaker also has a presentation. Yep. So our third speaker, let me introduce Dr. Rachel Ibrick, who is a lecturer in politics and international relations at Goldsmiths College, University of London as well, just as Yasna. However, her research interests include human rights activism, political violence, humanitarianism, and transitional justice, especially in Eastern Africa, and in particular in Rwanda and also in South Sudan. She's also a research associate at the Conflict Research Program at the LSE, and she's widely published in a variety of international journals, and she's also the author of South Sudan's Injustice System, Law and Activism on the Frontline, which is from last year. The title of her presentation is We Should Have Learned from Rwanda, the Regional Political Opportunities and Constraints of a Hegemonic Narrative of Genocide, Memory and Justice in Eastern Africa. We're very much looking forward to the presentation, Rachel. Thank you for being here, and the virtual floor is yours.
Thank you. So step back. Okay. I want to thank Jesse and Joanna for involving me in the conference, which I'm taking really as an opportunity to test out some preliminary thoughts relevant to one of the questions on our agenda. And this is the question of what constitutes hegemonic narratives in or after conflict. And I want to elaborate really on this kind of discussion in the literature, a sort of transcultural turn in the literature, which explores how hegemonic narratives of atrocity travel and open the way to sort of distinctive effects with local sensibility. So they have different impacts in different contexts. And my argument really is that they open the way to contests over memory and justice even before a conflict has ended. And I want to demonstrate this argument really by looking at the case of South Sudan. So, firstly, we already know from the literature that there's a lot of discussion about the way in which memory travels. It's unbound, it's fluid and flexible. It's globalized, but at the same time, I think much of this literature shows that it remains contested, contingent, and ambiguous in ethical terms. And I'm particularly interested in an idea that was shared by Levy and Snyder some time ago, this idea of this kind of emergence of cosmopolitan memories, which have in some way provided a cultural foundation for human rights. And in particular, they talk about the memory of the Holocaust. And this really came into previous work that I did looking at the genocide in Rwanda, where Holocaust discourses and experts influenced the memorialization of the genocide. And at the same time, the memory of Rwanda's genocide was also itself sort of transnationalized and taken up in international and regional policy and commemorations. And in those commemorations, I have previously argued that what we see is both a sort of international politics of regret, which is politically significant in various ways, but also this sort of shaping of a dominant official narrative, which has also traveled, that has been influenced by national political imperatives. And so I really want to think about how the narratives of the 1994 genocide against Tutsi in Rwanda have traveled beyond Rwanda in the region, and what is their relevance for human rights cultures in the region. And in particular, I want to explore the effects in South Sudan during the civil war between 2013 and 2019. It's still sort of simmering. I'm drawing here on research that I've done on justice in South Sudan during the civil war, and in particular in sort of my involvement in civil society processes aimed at memory and justice. So I'm not really outside of this, it's somewhat engaged research. And firstly, I think a key point to make is that there is this kind of regional memory of genocide which has emerged. It's sort of institutionalized itself in the regional body. The African Union in particular has been shaped quite profoundly by the memory of the genocide. And this is for historical reasons, in part because at the moment of the birth of the African Union was also just sort of quite in the aftermath of the genocide in Rwanda, and in particular in the aftermath of an investigation in which the OAU looked at its own record, as many international organizations did during the genocide, and its failings. And these kind of reflections shaped the principles and practices of the African Union in really quite profound ways, including in what shaping this constitutive act, which in a way was sort of the first iteration of a kind of idea of a responsibility to protect, giving the African Union the right to intervene in respect of grave circumstances, including war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. And we've seen further evolution of thinking about responding to atrocities at the regional level, including in African Union policies on transitional justice, which started being made from 2009, and more recently a policy was published, and in annual genocide commemorations, which take place at the African Union in Addis Ababa, where they commemorate the genocide in Rwanda, and finally in an African Union human rights memorial, which you can see pictured in this slide, which was a project actually that I was also involved in, and I organized a number of consultations which were bringing together people across the region to reflect on past atrocities and how they should be memorialized. And as you can see from this quotation taken from one of the presentations during these consultations from an AU official, he talked about the fact that the AU memorial had really originated in the resolution taken on 7th of April 2004 on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, and that it was also sort of moving beyond the genocide in Rwanda to think also about the remembrance of the Red Terror massacres and also slavery and apartheid. And I've written about this process in an article in African Affairs with Alex Duval, but really the key point to note is that here we see the institutionalization really of the memory of the genocide of Rwanda, but also its extension beyond. And in those consultations, we also had, for instance, other Africans, including South Sudanese, then Under Secretary of the Ministry of Culture, Jock Madut Jock, who was thinking about how to build a national memory in South Sudan at the time. It was back in 2012. And really, I think that is one of the reasons that I've been prompted to think further about the relations between these two events and how the memory of the genocide in Rwanda might shape prospects for human rights in South Sudan. And for anyone who knows anything about South Sudan, you will know that is a war-torn state in the most sort of profound way. We've seen a proliferation of atrocities from slavery to violent colonial pacification and two civil wars. And these atrocities have largely been forgotten. And we can talk about a sort of oblivion, a vacuum of memory in South Sudan prior to 2005. And this very much relates to this idea that Sharon Hutchinson uncovers within the South Sudanese state, that the heart of the state was really this notion of a power to kill without accountability. It was very much kind of an expression of the necropolitical, idea of the state. And as Zoe Cormack, one of the few scholars to really have looked into memory practices and memorialization in South Sudan, shows, there's, sort of emergence of rare local memorials, but even in these, what we note after 2005 is the interpenetration between different regimes of memory and between local and globalized memory practices. So I want to take it on from there to think about what happened after, well, during an ongoing civil war and after the first wave of atrocities in 2013 in December in Juba. And I think very notably, the first thing relevant to the way in which the regional memory has sort of shaped this response. We see that the African Union was very quick to mount an inquiry, and in this inquiry, it was very emphatic about the need for truth, justice, and reparation, something which had really not been considered in the 2005 peace agreement at the end of the previous civil war. And since then, we've also seen numerous initiatives to kind of learn from Rwanda. We've seen South Sudanese traveling to Rwanda, including chiefs, including young people, as part of civil society initiatives to really sort of teach Rwandese about the teach South Sudanese about the Rwandan experience, and to think about its relevance to their own prospects for peace. And I've actually, you know, to somewhat been involved in some of this thinking about transitional justice in South Sudan. So, you know, but there's been a number of civil society, and this is really how I've come to understand it. But there's also been quite sort of strong claims being made that, you know, they've come away with ideas that if Rwandans can forgive, why not the South Sudanese? And for instance, you'll see on the Aegis Trust website, they talk about the idea that this memory, this kind of experience has really sort of contributed to saving lives. So I want to think now, and in fact, it's not only chiefs that have been going, we also see a hint of the regional tensions in the fact that one of the key, the former chiefs of staff of the SPLA in South Sudan, he traveled to Rwanda also and laid wreaths at the mass graves there. But, you know, there's a, his argument was we share a common background of armed struggle. This is someone who is under sanctions, international sanctions for his role in the conflict, including accusations of war crimes. And within South Sudan, we've also seen sort of concrete ways in which genocide memory has manifested itself, including in the 2019 commemoration of the genocide in Rwanda in the United Nations Protection of Civilian Sites in Juba. And you can see here the peacekeepers talking about the ways in which South Sudan can learn from Rwanda's experience, and a bishop also talking about Rwanda as an example for the whole world, including for South Sudan. And I think there have already been, just the very existence of these sites actually demonstrates quite a fundamental learning, the fact that the United Nations peacekeepers opened their gates and gave shelter to 200,000 civilians in their sites, in contrast to what happened during the genocide in Rwanda, is itself quite significant. And within these sites, so we see the memory of Rwanda shaping the kind of very existence of these sites. We should see commemorations by UN peacekeepers in these sites, but we also see, and you can see in this picture here, commemorations of the atrocities that took place in Juba in December 2013 and later. So the massacres that have taken place during the war in South Sudan are also commemorated in these sites. And outside, actually, and here is a picture from the Protection of Civilian Sites of a commemoration process taking place there. And I've got some text there from an interview with a lawyer who I work with on other research. And he was talking, he organizes these events, and he talks about the fact that really this is a determination to ensure that the 15th of December will never be forgotten. And so you see the sort of echo of memory practices there too. I think what fundamentally we can see is that post 2013, we have seen really shifts towards ending silence and impunity for atrocities in South Sudan. And memory practices that, you know, are unprecedented really in this country, including an online memorial for instance, popular evidence that at the popular level, there's a real demand for truth, justice, and reconciliation and healing demonstrated by the Law Society survey. And within the peace agreement, very significantly, chapter 5 of the peace agreement includes agreed principles for transitional justice. Of course, a real reluctance to implement those, but nevertheless very significant. Now, one of the problems here is that, of course, this is a selective narrative of the genocide. And memory that it continues to be contested in Rwanda is obviously not understood as such in South Sudan. And I mean, there's a whole sort of series of critiques of this selective memory in Rwanda, which I won't go into now. But it is simply to say that what we learn, you know, what reaches South Sudan instead is a much more selective narrative, the hegemonic narrative that has been institutionalized at the regional level. However, despite my sort of sense of the troubling exclusions in Rwanda's selective memory, I want to hold to the view that this commemoration opens up rather than silencing struggles for memory and justice in South Sudan. And in particular, I was inspired to think about this and to write about this by an encounter in the Ministry of Interior when I was researching my book, which is pictured above there, South Sudan's Injustice System, which, as you can imagine, is pretty critical of the law in South Sudan. And I was rather nervous because the research was sensitive and maybe foolishly was reading this book pictured below, The Law's Fragile State by Mark Massoud. And I was asked by a uniformed officer to hand him the book and tell him what it was about. So I passed him Mark Massoud's book, hoping that, you know, I wouldn't be asked to in too much detail about my own research. And I talked to him a bit about what the contents of the book, and he simply and his response was kind of surprising and it stuck with me since. He simply said, we should have learned from Rwanda. And I think this illustrates the way, the sort of symbolic power of the memory of the genocide in Rwanda. It drives a recognition that the state cannot simply kill with impunity and that ordinary people's lives matter. And so even if there are problems with this paradigm in terms of how it shapes transitional justice, and that's something I'm thinking a bit more about in other work, at the same time, memory, I think, creates political opportunities and is harnessed as a symbolic resource for counter-hegemonic struggles in South Sudan and the region.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Rachel. We now have a few minutes left for questions. We've already received some questions. I feel both of them are for Yasna, but I think either Rachel or Lord Adadice might actually have some thoughts on the first one. So let me pose this to Lord Adadice. Effie Butira from Oxford is asking, is there a particular time frame that is required to allow for questions about the past, traumas or victories to be articulated?
Well, there are two aspects to this question, Jesse. The obvious one, which is how long do you need to leave it before people can start talking about these things? And I remember a painful personal experience. I was on Belfast City Council just immediately after we had the ceasefires. I proposed that we should have a memorial window or something of the kind for all of those who had died in the Troubles. And I was attacked ferociously by all sides. On the unionist side, I was attacked because they didn't want their people to be memorialized alongside the IRA. And on the Republican side, I wasn't sufficiently recognizing the misdemeanors of the British security forces. So one lesson I learned from that is there certainly is a period. I don't think it's a period of time that you can define in terms of it needs to be a week, a month, a year, or a decade, because it depends very much on the circumstances and the context and history. But is there a need for a time? Yes, and there will be some people for whom never is too short, you know, that they will never want to engage in these kinds of things. So that's one side, is how soon can you do it? The other side is how long does it continue? One other experience from Belfast City Council is that on the 1st of July, every year, still now, there is a meeting of the City Council to remember those who died at the Battle of the Somme in the First World War. Now you can imagine in the context of a Brexit debate, what sort of things does that raise up? The idea that continuing to remember is always a good thing, it's not so simple. Of course, what you can do is try to find a way of turning that memory to a different kind of use. So for example, the memories of the First World War, which could have been very negative, were turned to some degree of advantage by saying, But don't forget, that was before partition. At that time, Protestants and Catholics fought together a common foe. Therefore, there have been histories of us doing things together, and maybe we can celebrate those from the past more than those periods where we were divided. So there isn't a simple answer to the question. If you try doing it too soon, you'll get in trouble. But if you keep on doing it in the same way without any reinterpretation, it can also cause you trouble.
Thank you very much, John. We've got two questions for Jasna. Jasna, I'm just going to ask you one, and then I'll maybe ask you if you could answer the other one in a written form. Marika Jolai from Brighton is asking a question. Firstly, thank you for an insightful presentation. How does Serbia's transition from memories created as part of the post-World War II Yugoslav past to the memory works regarding the wars of the 1990s in the context of drawing on Germany's experience?
Okay, thanks, Jesse, and thanks for the questions. I've seen them all, so I will try to reach out to people independently. I think there's a way of linking the first question that Lord Alderdice has just replied to as well, and I'll be very brief. I think it's, and again, here, drawing on the German experience, I think is really interesting in that many historians have by now shown that it is a mistake to think of the first 20 years in Germany as a period of silence. I mean, I'm thinking here of the work by historians such as Robert Mueller and others who have shown that there were attempts, even at the time, to make sense of the recent past and of the Nazi period and throughout this period. But the narratives that were articulated focused on certain aspects of that experience rather than others. So the most important experience for Germans during this time was, of course, the question of German victimhood, which formed the dominant narrative of those first 20 years. And again, drawing on then Marika's question on the continuities and the parallels, I think we can look at that, and we can also see very much the same phenomenon taking place in Serbia in the last 20 years. I mean, the main trope, of course, has been of Serbian victimhood, and that is very much across the board in terms of the political discourses that we have seen. And there, in terms of continuities with the Second World War, now in relation to Serbia, it is very much the same victims who are being drawn out in both cases. So the victimhood narratives continue. And so this, you know, the idea in the nationalist narrative is very much of the Serbs being the victims of the 1990s, as well as in the Second World War. So that would be a continuity and a linkage, I think, to the experience of Germany in the immediate post-war period.
Thank you so much.
And I will endeavor to answer Olga's question.
Thank you. Rachel, I was wondering, just a last question to wrap up. You mentioned the concept or the idea of that there's a few vacuums of memory. And I was wondering whether you could elaborate on that a little bit, whether those are really vacuums or whether these are white spots that are made out of fear or intimidation, or who are the ones that could potentially in the future fill in these vacuums? Are there still, you know, survivors that could actually invigorate this memory?
Well, when I was talking about this kind of oblivion in the past, I'm talking about previous atrocities in civil wars in Sudan that are not publicly remembered, that, you know, survivors don't even really define or kind of coalesce around that memory. I think in contemporary context, there are also, you know, I mean, the war is still... so we're sort of in a fragile peace. And so, I mean, there are many things that are not known about all the kind of aspects of the conflict as it's continuing. And it's not really in the past. I mean, it kind of relates a little bit to this problem of when do you start talking about the past, because this is still very much part of the contemporary present and very recent past. For instance, the memory of the New York genocide that I was talking about being commemorated in the protection of civilian sites. I mean, this is, you know, a very recent memory, and it continues to affect people's lives. They're still displaced. the conflict is not over. They're being protected by the United Nations peacekeepers. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but it's simply to sort of show that this is a country in which, you know, there are many silences.
Thank you very much. And thank you to the panel. We are now moving to the break. And I'd like to ask the panelists, there's a few questions on the Q&A still. There's one for John and a couple for Jasna. If you had a bit of time just to answer these questions to our audiences. I will also enable the chat function. So feel free to use the chat function now if you want to exchange more details or more links and so on. And I really want to thank our first panel, and we will meet here. I do apologize, I have eaten into our coffee break, but we will meet here again in about 5 minutes for our second panel. Thank you very much.